Hey, yo, this is Big Daddy Kane, and you're listening to another hot interview on The Library with Tim Einenkel on rapstation.com.
Yo, Daddy-o, school him some more.
This straight from the mouth.
Oh, why?
And Daddy-o,
do a crime,
end up in jail,
and gotta go.
Because you could do crime and get paid today.
He's the creator of Stassasonic. He's a music producer, an artist development coach, a speaker, a celebrity DJ. He just released his newest album, hashtag Everybody But KRS. He's Daddy-O, a.k.a. Professor Daddy-O, and I want to welcome him to The Library with Tim Einenkel on rapstation.com. Daddy-O, thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, man, my pleasure, man. Thanks so much for having me.
Argue for you reach the bank. Can't be capped before you reach the rank. Loud and clear, we go air it out and let you know what it's all about. Loud
proud. So, you know, I obviously want to start from, I want to, of course, talk about the new album, but I want to start from the beginning, I guess. You know, you came out at a time where there was when there was groups. You had like Tribe, you had De La, you had Public Enemy, you had Cypress, N.W.A., you know, EMP, right. EPMD, just to name a few. But today it seems like there's a lot less groups. Why do you think that is the case?
Well, the group thing is a good question. It probably, it's a challenge to your listeners, man. And just being the professor I am, I try to put everything into a lesson plan, right? So. Just homework for your listeners, man. It'd be nice to see what somebody could get back to you either by Twitter, you know, hitting you on Twitter or hitting you via email as to what they think. Because that's a study within itself.
I mean,
you know, it's one side of it is very dark, right? Which is, you know, going back to the Motown days and always, you know, seeing, you know, members of groups being taken out of the original group and then just kind of spawning these solo careers. You know, so that's kind of dark in terms of just, you know, pulling somebody out of a group just because, you know, with the group, there was less money.
Right.
But I think, you know, it's just me kind of thinking, but I think a lot of it is kind of based on ego and money. I mean, I can't see it being any other way because we were so enamored to be groups, right? So Chuck's a good friend and you know, all these guys are good friends, right? Because we ended up touring together and just becoming friends through the music. And we were all enamored by being groups. And the only ones that had the problem, surprisingly, was the two-man groups. I mean, they had to work so hard. I mean, if you talk to Eric and Parrish about how hard that was, because, you know, there was really not a bunch of two-man groups even in the beginning. You had Jekyll and Hyde, and you had the L Brothers really, really early. But for the most part, you know, people was looking for three, four, five. A lot of times people were looking for four or five members. So that, you know, so they could spread that thing out, spread the MCs across, do the routines. The routines would sound real thick with four people. So two people was like, well, what are we doing as two people? We're a duet, you know. So even that was difficult, but people were enamored. I'm going back to the original. People were really happy to be a group because we were following our predecessors, right? So we were following Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five, the Treacherous Three, a Fantastic Five, Macedon Committee. I mean, I could go on and on and on, you know, Jazzy Five. So we were following our predecessors, following our heroes. So we were so enamored to be a group. The only solid answer I could give you is that their heroes nowadays are solo artists.
Right.
So, you know, they seem to look toward Pac, Biggie, and Jay.
I think it's interesting that, like, obviously you and Chuck and, you know, and all these guys came out at a time where hip-hop wasn't the popular genre, right? So
right,
you had to look for other genres of music to get inspiration from, or you always hear those stories about, you know, I was growing up with, my dad was playing Motown and my mom was playing this, you know,
right.
And now you have, I mean, like you say, now you have artists are growing up where hip hop is the popular genre. So they're influenced
right,
by
right.
that, and they're influenced by solo artists. So, and that gets into another, obviously, Stassasonic influenced, I think, a lot of people. And obviously you guys have the title, Talking All That Jazz, which I was in elementary school and I grew up listening to that. And, and also when I was preparing for, my interview with you, of course, Self-Destruction, the lyric, yo, daddy, yo, scoop, 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 scoop. And that was like my favorite
right.
line. But anyway, back to talking about that jazz and the jazz influence that you guys had and the live instrumentation that you guys used. It seemed to help
it seemed to help
pave the way for jazz sampling groups as producers, like such as Q-Tip, Premier, Gangstar, Tribe, and even The Roots. Do you think, how much of an influence do you think you guys had on these groups? Or do you think it's just the natural progression of music that this happened?
I think it's both. I think there was a lot of influence. You know, one of the things I am super happy about. I mean, there's a bunch of things I am, but one of the specific things I'm super happy about was Schizophrenic, right? Schizophrenic is actually the rappers' rappers, right? So even when we didn't penetrate the overground, our peers loved the hell out of us.
Right. Yeah.
I remember being in a limousine. I think it was the Def Jam tour. Must have been the Def Jam tour. I don't think it was Big N Def. I think it was Def Jam tour. And we had to go do interviews. And so what would happen is, of course, LL would come by himself. And then sometimes Houdini would come, two of them, and sometimes just one of them would come. But, you know, we all had to fit in this limousine. So I was the only one from Stetsasonic there. And I remember LL just quoting the whole, Ghost Detson, I was amazed. I'm looking in his face like, I couldn't believe what I was seeing.
Oh, my God,
he just goes through, he says, yeah, man, you know, when that Ghost Detson, man, grace yourself for the awesome and rare, the real, and he's doing it like me.
Wow.
In my face. And I'm like, what the hell? But as time went on, I found that people really, you know, inter-industry people really, really loved us. Another experience I had in Selma, just recently, we had that Selma thing, you know, with the anniversary. And I'm standing in a room, and it's a room packed full of people and artists. And Ruben Studdard walks in, sees me, and walks directly to me. And people are yelling, Ruben, Ruben, and all of this. He's not paying attention. He's coming directly to me to tell me how much of an influence and how much of a fan he is of the group. So we, you know, that's one of the things I do pride in. So, I did, you know, the first part is that I think that we did definitely influence them because, you know, all of our chops, you know, in musician terms, all of our chops was hip-hop chops, right? We were, you know, one thing I will say about me and Chuck, and I'm not trying to say other people didn't do this. One thing I will say about me and Chuck, we stayed in that mold, I could almost say trying to make Melly Mel proud. You know what I'm saying? Trying to make Flash proud. We stayed in the mold of real hip-hop chops. And so you're not going to get that with everybody. Even with Tribe, you don't get a whole bunch of it. You get some really new nuances with Tribe. I love Q-Tip and Shahi because some of the things that they did were just, it was really fresh. Like, it was just, I don't even know if they knew they could do it. You know what I mean?
Right.
But if you listen to Public Enemy instead of Sonic, you hear Melly Mel. You hear Grandmaster Caz. You hear Grandmaster Flash. And theater, you hear that in our music, as well as, you know, what I consider the space that's not there, which is, you know, what was going to be future for it. But you hear that. We were all about the hip-hop chops. And I think that that's where Stet did end up influencing some of these other groups, because we kept it 100% hip-hop. So, you know the time signatures, the rhyme sequences, you know, the scratches, all of those particular things we put pretty much in this filter of hip hop chops, and you know, not looking at it like we didn't want to be un-hip hop, put it like that.
Right.
You know, it was just something about it that we wanted to make sure that whatever original hip hop had, which was all the stuff that we used to listen to on tour buses that was on tapes that never ended up being records, we had all of that, but then we still translated into that recording medium.
Did you guys know at the time? I mean, did you know at the time that you were having this profound effect on other MCs? I mean, I ask this because, you know, I asked producers and DJs and, you know, I said, I'm interviewing Daddy-O. What should I ask him?
Right.
You know? And the most common song that came up was, you have to ask him about Ghost Dessa off of your debut album, On Fire. And then they want to know, like, how did you, like, they're like, it's such a classic song. So the question is, like, did you guys know?
No, absolutely not. The answer is no. And here's the real deal. My two most classic mistakes is Ghost Detson and Top Villain, right? Both some, I'm talking about some unorthodox stuff. So Ghost Detson is this song that we're doing. We knew the style. I took the Lindrum and I did that old school James Brown beat, that boom, that, da doom doom. That, to do that, to do that. Now, if you listen to that, and you listen to, now take a sec to check the pedigree.
Yeah.
You will hear that it was written to boom, that's the boom, boom, that's the boom, that, right?
Yeah.
What happens is the engineer that I'm using doesn't come in one day in Calliope. And so they give me this long-haired Canadian Bob Colter, right? And he comes in, and Bob is, I don't know, because Bob Powell was my original engineer. Bob is maybe 15, 20 times faster than Power in terms of pulling up a mix. Literally, I didn't know you could pull up tracks that quick because I was so used to looking at Bob Power, who takes all day on the kick, all day on the snare. Like, before we hear the drum, we done went downstairs and ate lunch and come back, right?
Right.
Bob just pushes everything up. And what he did is he pushed up the vocals first and then the live drums. I added the live drums because I wanted drum rolls and cymbals on that record. That was the reason I put live drums on it. But what happened is, in order for the record, in order to do what I was asking him to do, the drummer had to keep a beat. Just to keep a beat. He couldn't sit there, you know, feet not moving, you know, hands at his side. And then because I literally use signs for it. I raised the sign for drum roll and then directed drum roll because he had to be in beat. So he was doing the beat just to keep the beat and where I wanted the roll and where I wanted the cymbal and all of those particular things. When Colter pulled this up, I'm like, yo, that's crazy. I said, yo, erase all electronic drums. He looks at me and said, are you sure? I said, erase them. He said, you don't want me to just mute them? I said, get rid of them. I said, Delight, that's the record.
Wow.
He listened to it. He said, yo, that's crazy, yo. I said, yo, turn them drums up a little bit more, because what people don't know about Ghost Death is only three drum tracks.
Wow, yeah.
We used to use one ambient drum that was way in the bathroom in the backing calliope and two stereo tracks. That's it. But it's the way those guys used to record. We had some incredible, we had some incredible engineers at Calliope, so that's the way they used to record. But that was the way that came about. That record was never supposed to be live drums. I mean, live drums, yes, I was doing live drums for my rolls and my cymbals, but it was never supposed to be live drums all the way through. But once we heard it, we was like, yo, this is undeniable.
So usually you kind of had a plan in terms of what you wanted, but this seems to be the case where
So how did Prince Paul, a lot of people don't know this about Paul, but Paul is phenomenally organized, right? So having Prince Paul always helped. Right, and Paul taught me like all of these friggin' techniques. So one of the things that Paul always does, and I do now as a producer, is he says, write down all the titles. Even before we get ready to go into, making this record, write down all the titles. Write down every title that you could think about for this record. I know that, the name of the album, that title is going to be that title song, but, give me at least 19, 20 more of them joints. And so that's what we used to do. And so I'm saying that's just part of the planning. And we moved into this kind of strategic mode of planning out what we wanted to do, what kind of records we wanted to make, because we're looking at all of these titles. And then, the other thing that was very, very, very beneficial in Stage of Sonic, and going back to your original question, it was just dope having a big-ass group because everybody could kind of share duty. So now we got all these titles, but we got DB, who's a producer. We got Paul, who's a producer. You got Daddy-O, who's a producer. And then the rest of the guys are kind of in there, at least knowing about production. They're not full-fledged on a production tip, but they definitely have ideas. So those things could be divided and split up amongst us, and sometimes somebody would come up with something crazy. Like, for instance, Fuquan made the beat for Sally because we had this idea that everybody was going to do a solo record on the album, right? It didn't happen like that. Only on N4Gear, the only thing that came was the ODAD, and then... actually two, because it was ODAD and Freedom of Death for me. And then we still didn't look at Faye as a solo record. We still looked at Faye like it was a group record. It's just that we knew we needed one voice on Faye because we were just following Lottie Dottie and LaToya and some of those other records that was out. But Fuquan's record never came out right. The one they did, we didn't like it. And, it was always by committee. But when we left him in the studio that day, he came up with that beat for Sally. And I was like, yo, I could use this for this, talking about mistakes, I could use this for this record idea I got, right? So back in the day, when Flash and them used to Dan and all of them, Jazzy J and them, used to cut breaks, there was a few breaks that had words in them. So Keep Your Distance was one, the one we used for Sally, the Dyke and the Blazers was one, Champ is kind of one because it got, it does say Champ. But there was a few break beats that had words in them. I had wrote this song that had every break beat that had words in it. So, you know, go a little bit, but and to know what I'm talking about, just listen to It's In My Song on the Info Gear album, and you'll hear what I'm saying. Because I did that. I talk back and forth with the turntable on my verse, and it's in my song. It's just like I talk, and then, you know, the scratch comes in, and I talk, and the scratch comes in. So that's the way this record was. But then what happened was, you know, they all was good, but that Dyke and the Blazers thing stood out. And I said, man, forget this. I'm scrapping everything, and I'm just using that. Some people don't like the way Sally walked, and we're going to just write three verses around. Well, really four, because we did three, and then we did the one collective verse. We're going to just write verses around that, some people. And I'm using that beat that Fuquan had made, and then Paul was like, yo, hold on a second. And then Paul brought that, down, down, down. He's like, watch this, man, yo. Down, down, down. I was like, yo, that's crazy right there, yo. Just with that beat, that down, down, down. I was like, yo, this is crazy. I was like, how are you going to use that James Brown? I don't know who it was. I think it was Rufus Thomas. And he said, watch how I use it. And it was just, it was bananas, yo. It was like, you know, that was crazy. So that, you know, it's the creative process. I mean, I know I did turn a little bit, but the creative process was always very interesting for us because we already had a structure. And so, you know, anything that we added usually was dope, dope gravy for us. You know what I'm saying? Because there was already something there that we wanted to do.
That gets me to my next question. I know you're not just obviously you're not just an artist and a music producer, but you're also an artist development coach. So
right.
When you have like stories that which this is for me the most fascinating thing about the kind of the creative mind of the artist, how you know you have a plan, something changes, and you just or you have a plan, something happens, you know that you're going to scrap that. And
right.
you go with that, and it's just fascinating to me to realize how people's minds work in that way, and how
right.
they have this great ear. But so I guess my question is, how are these? Can you teach this? I mean, like,
all right, so yeah, so shameless plug, artdevclinic.com is the site. Right now, all I'm doing is evaluation, so it's a little bit more than virtual A&R. But can you teach? Absolutely, because I was taught it. So absolutely, it can be taught. Because I was taught. You know, the one thing I always say about the music business that I miss is I miss that. I mean, I really, really miss that. I remember days of Gary Harris and Russell Simmons and Cassandra Mills. Just, Daddy-O, do you know so-and-so? Oh, you need to know so-and-so. And, you know, just the connectors. And then if there's something that you don't know about a mic or something that you don't know about rhyme cadence or something you don't know about DJing or needles or whatever, they would always show you what could be done. I think it's more teachable, and that's the only reason I started the Art Dev Clinic. I think it's more teachable now than it's ever been because now we have some form of structure in mind. I mean, you mentioned earlier, you know, at the time that we began this thing, we weren't the popular music. So, you know, it was a little different because all of us was finding our mojo and trying to figure out how to get it going anyway.
Right.
But now that it's going, and you got stations shouting out home of hip-hop and R&B, you know,
yeah.
Now there is some kind of structured thing to it. And the thing I try to do and talk about all those times is, I tell this to artists that I work with all the time. If your intention is just a little bit of radio play and blah, 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 that's not me. I'm not the guy to come to.
Right.
But if you're trying to be a superstar, if you're trying to last, if you're trying to not be forgotten, then I'm that guy. Because that's what I'm trying to work you out. You know what I'm saying? I have nothing but heroes in my mind. And the concept of all of this, to me, at the end of the day, should be legendary status. If you're not doing this to be the best, you probably shouldn't be doing it at all. And so, you know, so that's where my, you know, that's my guidance and that's my area is toward that thing. And then, you know, most of what I do in the very beginning is just all stage performance, you know, because the truth of the matter is that today and yesterday, a good show will sustain you either way. You know, now it may seem a little bit more prevalent because people really are not selling records the way they used to. But if you think about it, even the guy that ended up doing $10 million in a finger snap hammer, he did it because his show was hot.
Right.
You know, he didn't do it just because those records, you know, people are still questioning as to whether or not Hammer's records was dope or not. You know, when you guys play records and y'all going to old school sets, hardly none of y'all play Hammer. You know, it's weird, but y'all just don't. Because it's like y'all trying to figure out, yeah, maybe some guys on the West Coast may pull a little piece out, but y'all don't really get into that. When y'all start getting down, y'all start getting into the Tribe. Y'all will play Rodney on Joe Cooley before y'all will play him. Y'all would play Ain't No Future in Your Front and MC Breeze before y'all would play him. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's the jury is still out as to whether or not he made those records. But what sold those records and millions and millions of those records was that he had a dope show. So the first thing I concentrate on is a show, because that definitely can be taught. And it's definitely something that's totally missing in this era. These guys come out on stage, they harmonizing with themselves. They make a record at one octave. They on stage at another octave. It doesn't even seem like that's the guy that made the record. They have no idea about what movement is. Just like they don't know how to hold a gun, they don't know how to hold a mic.
Right, right.
You know, it's a weird, weird situation. And what ends up happening is that they don't realize it, but the reason they don't get repeat performances is because they was whack. They think it worked, but they so high that they don't know whether or not it works or not. So, you know, there's a whole bunch of stuff to teach in that area in terms of, you know, because my whole issue is, you know, can you get to a sustainable level? We could talk about being the best down the road, and the aim is always that, but can you even get to a sustainable level? Because we've noticed, and especially in the last two decades, that, you know, people have not even thought about sustainability. What they've thought about is shooting up the rung to be wherever they're going to be at the very, very top. And then they fall really hard and fast.
Right.
And then it just goes away because, you know, that's a tough thing. You know, take a person from 0 to 100 and then they operate at 100 for, I don't care how long, maybe it's 10 months, maybe it's longer. And then they just drop them back down. They don't know. So what I try to do is show them how to pace this thing, where, you know, down the line, you could kind of figure out what your placement is and get some work done. But, yeah, I mean, I know that's a long answer to one question, but, yeah, it could be taught.
So when you teach people how to, you know, this more sustainability stuff, are you also teaching them? Because what I find is you hear not just artists but also basketball players and, you know, whatever, right, sports stars who – They go from college, they have, or high school, they don't have much, and then they get that, you know,
right,
first $10 million check, right? And then they always talk about how they, this people come out of the woodworks, right? Like, you know, asking for this, asking for this, or, you know, and, or,
exactly,
or, yeah. So do you teach them how to get that, a trustworthy group? I mean, is it hard to teach them how to get a trustworthy group around them? You know, like kind of like a class?
No, I mean, and I do teach it, but I'm a lot. But that part is more, that's more of my screaming part. That's not the nice teacher in me. You know, that's this kind of screaming radical in me saying, you know, I actually just did a keynote at this summit here called the Bridge Summit. And that was the first thing, that was the thing I closed my talk with. And it was about teams. And I taught them about teams because my argument for that is this. I say it all the time. I say, you guys been told a lie, right? You've been told a lie. And they say, what do you mean? You know, what do you mean? I say, you know, everybody's running around here telling you that, you know, you don't need a record company. You know, you just don't need a record company. You can do it all yourself, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, that's a lie. And the reason I'm saying it's a lie is this. If you will propose what I call the desert island question, which is, you're on a desert island and you're going to be on this island for the rest of your life. You're not coming off. And you have 5 records to take on that island. Not one of those records are independent. They were all made by record companies. They were all made by incredible teams, right? So if it's hip hop, the Chronic might be in there. Take the Nation may be in there. And I could keep going on, you know, maybe Machiavelli for some people, maybe All Eyes on Me, maybe one of those Biggie records. I wouldn't take the Biggie record, but maybe one of those big records. You know what I'm saying? But those records are there. They were all made by teams. They were all made by record companies. There's a science to the way. I say it all the time to them. I say to them, look, we never put the words marketing and promotion in the same sentence. You guys are ridiculous to me. I hear y'all say marketing and promotion. What the hell is that? Promo is one thing. Marketing is a whole other thing. I've heard some of y'all say marketing, promotion, and publicity in one. What the hell is that? So what I'm learning is that they don't even have the concept in their head to know what a real team means. So I don't, in essence, I guess it is a teaching, but I'm kind of screaming that from the rafters, like, look, man, you're only going to bring your uncle in here if your uncle knows what he's doing. And that concept of bringing your uncle in here because you think you could trust him, you're delirious. You are delirious because you might have somebody that could trust that can't do a heck of business. You know, at the end of the year, you done made $10 when you could have made $100 just because the man didn't know what he was talking about. So, you know, and it's a fine line. I understand what it is that they're trying to do. I understand sometimes they want to get their little brother and their cousin in there just because, you know, this is somebody they could talk to. I get it. I just don't agree with it. So, yes, I often talk to them about what teams mean, you know, but just in that same context, it's like, yo, man, you got to realize that these great records that you hear, that you love and all of that, they were created by teams of people. These things wasn't created by, like, you know, in silos or on somebody's laptop. Even today, if you want to do a great record, and you could do a great record on your laptop, but if you don't have somebody like a Herbie Powers or one of these guys, Carlos or one of these guys, to master your record and do whatever, you're probably going to lose, you know, I don't know how many listeners just based on Sonic. You know,
right.
People don't really know. It's just that sometimes they, you know, they hear it and they just like, damn, I probably would play more of it, but it seems a little low. Doesn't feel like it's mixed right. I mean, you know what I'm saying? Because they don't know what you got to go through when you getting it in your hands. They're just looking at you like, oh, man, you the DJ, man. You better play my record because it's the best record in the world. But you got to play this record up against everything else that you got in your collection. And, you know, I mean, there's mixed fits, there's sonic fits, there's all those kind of things that's got to be the made to fit, and everything just is not the same sometimes when it comes off a laptop. You know that old school saying of, you know, I mean, the old school issue of, you know, cats who used to make, you know, music on their four tracks and then bring them in the studio and they hear all that noise and they're like, where's all that noise coming from? The engineer looks at them and said, it was there the whole time. It's just a damn tape. But in the house you can't hear it because you're listening on some house speakers that are colored. Now I'm here, it's pure, and you hear everything. So can you get it out? I can try. But it was made with that hiss.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? So, you know what I'm saying? So there's just a concept to that. The other thing I say about that is this, man, is that you can almost trace the decline, and I'm just going to talk about hip-hop right now. You can almost trace the decline of some of this hip-hop music to the MySpace time. And that was because people just literally gave up on their music and started programming a damn MySpace page. And then, you know, Facebook comes along, and then Twitter comes along, and Instagram comes along. And I don't know how much we're losing. I say it to them all the time. I don't know how much great art we're losing from y'all because y'all sitting there trying to manage your own social media. It's the dumbest thing you could ever do. You should be in the basement somewhere writing songs. I mean, how are we going to get all this great material if you're sitting there trying to figure out what your Instagram post looks like and you're resizing something?
Right.
How do we get that? You know what I'm saying? I understand you're at dinner or you're somewhere else and you want to just take a little picture or whatever. But even with that, somebody else taking a picture is always better for you. You can selfie it if you want, but somebody else taking a picture, always better for you. Somebody else documenting it with a little bit of film, always better for you. Because then you can concentrate on being you. You know, we got to get back to the music, and sometimes some of these other things have just totally distracted us. So, I mean, again, long answer to one question, but I definitely tell them about things that just, I think, is a little more harsh than just teaching them. I'm screaming.